David Brown is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine and the best-selling author of Goodbye 20th Century and other books. He also contributes to the New York Times, The New Republic, Spin, NPR, and other outlets. David's new book, Fire and Rain, The Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel, James Taylor, CSNY, and the Lost Story of 1970, tells the story of four iconic albums of that year and the lives and times of the artists who made them, all set against the backdrop of the turbulent turning of the decade. Welcome, David.
Glad to be here.
And thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us. First of all, for the listeners, can you just fill us in on what was the genesis of this book? Why did you pick 1970?
It was really the convergence of two ideas. The first one was that I've always wanted to write about the music of my youth, you know, the first records I ever owned. I've written books on more recent, more contemporary musicians like Sonic Youth and Jeff Buckley. But it was actually my wife one day who said, you know, at some point you really need to write about all that stuff, like Simon and Garfunkel and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young, and all those records that you got when you were 12 or whenever, and that you still listen to. You really need to deal with that at some point. And I said, yeah, you know, you're right. And at the same time, I've also always been fascinated with that period from the late 60s into the early 70s, musically, culturally, and otherwise. As someone who was a child of the 70s, or I came of age in the 70s, was a teenager then, and I think anyone who was roughly my age remembers, you know, hearing the same thing over and over again as we progressed through the 70s, which is, wow, you know, you just missed out on this incredible, glorious, mythical era called the 60s. You know, you missed out on the Beatles and Woodstock and JFK while he was alive and so forth. And now, well, welcome to where you are now. Welcome to Richard Nixon and gas rationing and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And so it's always, like, somewhat haunted me. Like, okay, what happened there? Like, when did the 60s give way to the 70s and what changed? And so when combining that with realizing that four of the key albums I owned when I was a kid, Let It Be by the Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water, Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and James Taylor's Sweet Baby James were all released in 1970, and I just thought, wow, there could be a really interesting story to tell if I put all of this stuff together and told the story of that year using music as the forefront to kind of tell the story.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, it might be my own boomer bias. I think we're almost exactly the same age, and I had all of those experiences that you described. But it still seems that many of these artists are dominating American culture today, 40 years later. Why is that?
Right. It's amazing. You know, in 1970, were we listening to Al Jolson records? You know, probably not. You know, at least most of us weren't. I really think it comes down to, on one hand, the songs. You know, a lot of the songs that I write about on those records, Bridge Over Troubled Water, Fire and Rain, Let It Be, Long and Winding Road, you know, Teach Your Children, Carry On, et cetera, et cetera. These have really become kind of modern American standards. They're not just, you know, not just sort of boomer rock classics. They're just great songs that have really stood the test of time. And I think there's also, I think maybe a lot of people like me just find something really fascinating about that era. It was sort of the end of the innocence for the music and the music business. And there's a real pull to that even goes beyond just how many of the great songs emerged from it.
Yeah, and I suppose the younger generations might say a couple of things. They might say, well, it's just nostalgia. Or they might say that, you know, the boomers are still kind of dominating and throwing their weight around in terms of, you know, the musical selections and influences. But I think maybe these albums, and you've obviously, you know, selected some of the key ones, are really kind of cultural touchstones, right, that have tremendous significance in the history of the country. And
they do, and I think together they tell a story, and there's a reason I picked those records even beyond the fact that I have my own personal connection to them, is that, as the book tells, you know, three of those records were by major iconic groups of the 60s, who fell apart that year, Beatles, Simon and Garfunkel, and CSNY. And from all that wreckage, who emerged as the big star of that year was James Taylor, who was, at the beginning of 1970, pretty much an unknown, just a kind of a cult folky playing clubs. By the end of 70, all of these classic groups had fallen apart, and he emerged kind of triumphant as the new bright new star of the year. And I think so. Well, you saw this sort of ushering in, falling away of so much that we associated with the '60s, and the rising up of a new sound, a new style, a new approach to music, a more personal, intimate, less political form of music that kind of came to dominate the '70s, or at least the first half of it. So these are really, these records to me really fit together in telling the story of that year. Also, these people all knew each other. It was, you know, we forget how young rock and roll was. Rock and roll was only about 15 years old at that point. That'd be like from going now back to the Spice Girls. You know, it's not that, you know, wasn't that old an art form at the time. And people knew each other. And the book documents everything from the time Stephen Stills moved to London for a while, was hanging out with Ringo Starr, to Joni Mitchell being with Graham Nash in the spring, and then breaking up with him, and she was with James Taylor later in the year, and kind of crossing of paths with Art Garfunkel and James Taylor at the first Greenpeace concert. So they, all these records to me, they fit together in a very natural way, and really did tell a story that I only sensed to some small degree when I even started the project, and it really grew as I worked on it.
Well, can you pick out a couple of anecdotes from the book? Tell us about the Beatles, for example.
By early 1970, the Beatles had pretty much splintered into their own camps. They were doing their own things. They hadn't made it clear to the world yet that they were breaking up. And Paul went off and started making his own record, which is the record came to be known as McCartney. And I was interviewing one of the recording engineers on that record, and he was, thank God, one of the few people from that era who still has his, like, day planner, you know, journal diary, you know. Very hard to come across those from 40 years ago. But he had it, and he flipped through it, and he came across his notes for the McCartney sessions. And at one point, he noticed that he had scratched out Paul's name, and over it he wrote "shh," and then the next day, in next day's entry, he referred to Paul as Billy Martin, and that became Paul's secret name, because Paul didn't really want to know, didn't want anyone to know, especially the other Beatles, that he was doing this, because this actually became really the big turning point in the breakup of the group, and he put out his own record and made this statement saying, "Okay, this is it for me. I'm doing this now." Things were getting kind of complicated in rock and roll that year, and they were getting more businesslike. You were seeing the rise of bigger fees for concerts, of acts moving away from, say, the Fillmore East and playing in Madison Square Garden, which began to spell the end of venues like the Fillmore East and West, which closed the following year. There were a lot of real turning points like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would you say were the most startling things that you learned in researching and writing the book?
I think there were a mix of startling moments, both musical and otherwise. For example, I'd completely forgotten that just a few weeks after Kent State, there were two kids, two African-American boys, shot down and killed at Jackson State in Mississippi. And musically, I was really struck by the pettiness and vitriol in the Beatle camp. As part of my research, I went to the National Archives, which is this big, beautiful building outside of London that houses all the Beatle court papers, which Paul filed on December 31st, 1970, as the ultimate New Year's Eve bummer to hand-deliver writs to Ringo, George, and John that day. And in those papers, which are, you know, considered so important that they're kept in a private vault, and you have to go into a room that's locked from the outside, and you can't use pencils with erasers and so forth to look at them. In those papers are all the back and forth correspondences between them, the letter that John and George wrote to Paul saying they were going to delay his McCartney album. Ringo hand delivered to Paul, and with George's little P.S. Hope my friend finds peace, Hare Krishna, kind of little dig at him, to the letter from Paul's people to Alan Klein, who was handling the Beatles business affairs that summer, asking for £1,500 a month in expenses, and him being turned down, you know, because they felt that Paul was the problem. And then at the same time, coming across the paperwork about the royalty check that the Beatles received that year for record sales, just from late 69 into 1970, getting a $10 million royalty check just from American record sales alone. And $10 million in 1970? Mm-hmm. I mean, what would that be now? A huge amount.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe that's why Paul McCartney calls Ringo, he doesn't call him Ringo, he calls him Rich.
Yeah.
Of course, we're here talking about the audiobook edition, and we do have a sample of that. I know you haven't heard the entire audiobook. We have a sample of that on Tantor.com. I'm just curious, what are your feelings, or what would you be listening for in an audiobook edition of this work?
I'd be kind of listening to the way that the transitions between the music and the music sections and what my editor called the cultural context copy, you know, which is where I describe the what was happening around these musicians, whether it was Kent State or the Jackson State shootings or the Apollo 13 debacle, which was that summer, which spelled the beginning of the end of the space program. So I'd be really fascinated to see how that all fits together. I know how it fits together in my mind, but it'll be really interesting to see, to hear somebody reading it and seeing how that flow works when it's read out loud, because I don't usually read my prose out loud when I'm finished.
I think the authors we've asked about this, they always find it an interesting experience to hear the book, especially read by a professional narrator like we have here, Sean Runnette. Thank you so much, David Brown, author of Fire and Rain, which is now available on audio from Tantor at Tantor.com. Thanks so much, David.
Alan, great to be here.